Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on altrighttv.com or whiteresistanceradio.com. You can reach us either way. And lots of unused views for our people. Of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. Well, lots of news to discuss today. Hardly know where to start, but there's going to be a protest this coming Saturday at 1 o'clock at the corner of Yonge and College Street in Toronto. That's 1 o'clock. It's going to be a protest against Communist China. Calling for a boycott of their products, an end to any discussion of importing the Huawei spy G5 technology into Canada, and an invocation of the Magnitsky Act, which allows us to freeze the accounts if they're here, and certainly ban travel to Canada of people involved in human rights abuses in Hong Kong and in Western China. But most of all, it's going to be standing up for our interests against the surging Red Chinese who have occupied territory of other countries, particularly Japan and Vietnam and the Philippines and the South China Seas. Red China is an expansionist, is an aggressor, and this protest is going to speak up against that at a time that this sort of honesty is very, very desperately needed. here's a very interesting commentary from a online publication called The American Thinker, by a conservative blogger named Bode Lang, and he regularly produces videos on YouTube, and this is about one of the ways that that the fake news media censors people. After decades of monopolizing nearly every form of mass communication, the left found its information cartel under siege with the new freedoms enabled by the social media. Conservative voices previously blacklisted from the mainstream could now reach large audiences and quickly became a severe threat to the narrative. It wouldn't take long before the left called for censoring or banning anyone to the right of communism under the guise of protecting us from hate speech and misinformation. Now the left's Orwellian censorship crusade has set its sights on the next frontier: ban all comments. You see, that's quite often what happens. A lot of newspapers in Canada that have an online component, or where the articles are online or news stories, allow for readers' comments. And often people are quite outspoken. Well, they don't like this free forum. We're supposed to take the delusional nonsense that we're fed, and passively just nod our heads and agree. The idea that there might be another position or many other positions is anathema to them. And so this banning or severe censorship of the reader's comments has been a big phenomenon recently. 2 years ago, I read the person responsible for that aspect of the Globe and Mail's operation. She waxed eloquent about having it being so necessary to curb impolite discussion, hate speech, reflections on race or nationality or religion. In other words, any of the things that honest people may disagree about. Recently, Yahoo replaced its comment section with the following disclaimer: our goal is to create a safe and engaging place for users to connect over interests and passions. In order to improve our community experience, we're temporarily suspending article commenting. Now, notice the absolute contradiction. Our goal is to create a safe and engaging place for users to connect over interests and passions. So we're going to shut you up. One of the recurrent themes and lies of our time is the apparent need for safe spaces. People have to feel safe. And how might you not feel safe? Well, if you're a cultural Marxist, you might not feel safe if somebody says something that is contrary to what you believe. I don't feel safe anymore. And so the only way for me to make you feel safe is to shut anybody else up. It's a rather beguiling easy step to censorship. This new policy is hardly surprising. Yahoo is well known for publishing headlines that do not accurately represent the story. Beneath the misleading title, the article is often a sloppy summary of the event written by an overeducated 20-something who took a break from writing about Kim Kardashian's lip care routine to inform us on political matters. After suffering through the unpalatable article, the payoff often was within the comments section, which can sometimes serve as a refuge where truth prevails in the form of thousands of comments eviscerating the fake news above. During the California wildfires and power outages of 2019, Yahoo published a story from Quartz titled, "California's Massive Power Outages Show Climate Change is Coming for Everyone, Even the Rich." The article shifted blame away from the bad environmental policies of California Democrats toward the climate change monster. Some of the most liked comments were, "This has nothing to do with climate change. Nice try, though. California's problems with electrical transmission due to restrictive environmental laws regarding tree clearing and lumber industry. Decades of fuel buildup become a disaster zone." Another comment: "Kansas has wind and droughts. Oddly, no fire issues. Guess clearing a dry bush. Guess clearing dry brush isn't a liberal choice." Another comment: I'm 53 years old. I don't have the best memory, but I do think I remember wind and warm weather in the summer while growing up in Northern California. I could be wrong, though. Maybe they didn't have weather back then. This humiliating saga for Yahoo went on for years. Finally, they'd had enough. What's the point of publishing propaganda if anyone can scroll down to the comments section and find the author's misleading representation of the story or deliberate omission of facts exposed? the mission to ban comments is not new, but Yahoo joined the boycott. Yahoo joining the boycott is revealing. A few years ago, major publishers like ESPN didn't appreciate what they found in their comments section. For ESPN and many other major websites, the problem was anonymity. The solution was requiring a Facebook login to comment on articles. This way, people will think twice before posting hate speech in comment sections if they're no longer anonymous. Of course, as we all know, hate speech is doesn't tell you much about what's written. It tells you a great deal about the accuser. It's speech the accuser hates. To ESPN's surprise, attaching identities before comment did not stop the barrage of ridicule toward ESPN for its partisan politics, support for the mixed-race Colin Kaepernick, and nauseating coverage of Caitlyn Jenner receiving the Arthur Ashe Award for courage. Having himself mutilated to become a pseudo-woman is an award for courage, I'd say. It's an award... should be pitied or given a notation for lunacy. The disdain for ESPN kept showing up within its comment section, triggering ESPN to delete them altogether. Many other white websites followed. Fake news is all in vain if John and Jane Doe from Milwaukee can quickly dismantle its work in a few sentences. Now comment sections are becoming an endangered species. Do not dismiss the abolition of comment sections as trivial or unimportant. The extinction of comment sections on websites like Yahoo and ESPN is a domino of falling within a larger inimical plot to ban all dissenting opinions. The left's utopia is a world where leftists can lie as much as they want and nobody can contest their claims. Twitter might be considered the most extensive comment section in the world, and like Yahoo, the media work hard to craft propaganda ripe to publish on it. The last thing they want is to have their lies exposed within replies to their tweets. Media elitists began pressuring Twitter to alleviate this predicament under the same phony pretense of stopping hate speech, abuse, and misinformation. Twitter soon developed new features allowing users to hide specific replies to their tweets to combat abusive comments. The people at Twitter claim that this ability to censor comments reduces the amount of toxicity on their platform. But toxicity does not mean Sarah Jeong's racism. She's a writer for the New York Times. Professors claiming that the GOP and the National Rifle Association want mass shootings or Antifa promoting violence. Things decent people might indeed consider toxic. In leftist newspeak, toxicity means any attempt to assail the left's narrative. Media attribute the motive for Twitter's changes as an appropriate response to pressure to clean up its platform. But as Dan Greenfield writes, quote, the pressure in question comes from the media, and its idea of cleaning up is censoring conservatives. Twitter is also testing a new technology, sending users a prompt when they reply to a tweet using offensive or hurtful language in an effort to clean up conversations on the social media platform. For the creator of fake news, the ideal solution is training people to self-censor. How quickly terms like pro-life and MAGA, let's make America great again, find their way on the naughty list of hurtful and offensive language. How this happens is unclear. How pro-life is somehow offensive. Well, I suppose it is offensive to an abortion-crazed maniac, but most decent people don't find it particularly upsetting. The purpose of eliminating comment section on websites and replies on Twitter is to regain the monopoly of information. A powerful weapon in the left's repertoire of indoctrination tools is presenting their opinion and beliefs as if they were ubiquitous. Social proof can supplant supporting evidence. Like, if everybody is saying that, well, then somehow it must be true. When the elites are ratioed on Twitter for fraudulent claims, it reminds users that opposition does exist. When articles smearing the McCloskeys for defending their home against violent mobs contain thousands of comments expressing support for the St. Louis couple, it undermines the illusion of unanimous agreement about the evil of that white couple that the writer of the piece might be trying to convey. Democrats do not want voters to realize that their radical opinions aren't the majority. As they move further left, the only way to uphold this illusion is to prevent unapproved opinions from entering the public view. Therefore, RIP, the comment section. one of the many victims of the cancel culture, the destruction of the vandalization of statues, etc. One of the many victims is the exhibit of John Wayne at the University of Southern California. And you wonder, what particularly was offensive about Mr. Wayne? A major actor in the 40s and 50s and 60s, and I guess maybe into the 70s. His name has been given to an airport in Southern California. The University of Southern California is removing the John Wayne exhibit after students asked for it to be removed. Now, there was a time that students went to university to learn, not to make demands. The University of Southern California School of Cinematic Arts will remove a John Wayne exhibit from its main building. Some students protested the exhibit last year. They cited that if the exhibit was left up, the university would be endorsing white supremacy. Endorsing white supremacy. The assistant dean of diversity and inclusion, Evan Hughes, shared a memo on the school's decision. And he wrote, I am writing to update you on plans for the Wayne exhibit, located in the main building of the School of Cinematic Arts Complex. He continued, conversations about systemic racism in our cultural institutions, along with the global civil uprising by Black Lives Matter movement, require that we consider the role our school can play as a change maker in promoting anti-racist cultural values and experience. Therefore, it has been decided that the Wayne exhibit will be removed. Now, who made this announcement? The Assistant Dean of Diversity and Inclusion. So let's see. We're going to have diversity and inclusion by getting rid of the John Wayne exhibit. That doesn't sound like inclusion to me. It sounds like reducing diversity. And these people have to be called on that. The utter contradiction, and the statement goes on, conversations about systemic racism, etc. And we consider the role our school can play as a change maker in promoting anti-racist cultural values. So School of Cinematic Arts, or Department of Cinematic Arts, doesn't see its role as promoting the craft, or dealing with the history of cinema, or anything of that. Its role is promoting and being a change maker. Well, why must the department be a change maker? And what type of change? Oh yes, well, in a way, he'll go on to tell us. temporarily lost this game. They want to promote an anti-racist cultural value, anti-racist cultural values and experiences. Well, what about promoting a good technique, a good craft, an understanding of the history of the development of cinema? So the department wants to be a propaganda agency. Anti-racist cultural values, whatever those are. And that's quite clear, they're anti-white. Okay, well, okay, what does this have to do with poor old John Wayne? Assistant dean of diversity and inclusion. I didn't think a person could actually be paid a salary for such nonsense. So the exhibit items will be removed to the Cinematic Arts Library archives, where other artifacts and papers of influential Hollywood figures reside for the purpose of research and scholarship. There's a John Wayne exhibit because he attended the University of Southern California in the 1920s and was also on the football team. In addition, some California Democrats are calling for renaming the John Wayne Airport. The resolution passed and the name will likely be restored to Orange County Airport. The reason why people are calling for the changes is that John Wayne once said in a 1971 Playboy interview that he believed in white supremacy. However, his youngest son, Ethan Wayne, recently released a statement that said his father did not support white supremacy in any way. Of course, all of this has to be taken in context. A 1971 Playboy interview, that's 49 years ago. What did white supremacy mean? Well, I don't have the interview in front of me. But even if John Wayne believed in the superiority of whites in some way, why should that disqualify the exhibit? And there's no good reason for that. He's honored not for his political views, whatever they might have been, but for his craft. There are many other actors, some who were actually communists or very close to the communist people, like Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall, and others were very far left wing. In some cases, and a lot of writers were named before the House Un-American Activities Committee. Should that disqualify them, where they might be honored for their work in the craft? Well, I would say, of course, it shouldn't. but this is the new cancel culture, and as we've perhaps observed many times before, it is often done under the guise of inclusion. In fact, in the Orwellian world that we live in today, very often concepts are the exact opposite of the label. There's still quite a bit of commentary on the evidence given by the two Kielberger brothers on Tuesday in the House of Commons, and tomorrow, Thursday, there will be a testimony by the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau for 3 hours before the Finance Committee to try to get to the bottom of who. Of his ties with the Kielberger charity empire, and what promises were made. It's interesting that his mother, Trudeau's mother, Margaret Trudeau Kemper, was paid, it turns out, almost $500,000. That's about $330,000 in fees for 28 appearances at We rallies, and a further almost $150,000 for travel expenses. And figures always have to be taken in context. To give you an example, back before the First World War, it was said that a dollar a day was a white man's pay in North America. So the pay for a relatively unskilled white laborer would be a dollar a day. That has to be put in into the context of what it might cost to a dollar a day today. Of course, wouldn't even buy, in most cases, buy a cup of coffee. So in context, well, $150,000 for travel expenses for 28 gigs amounts to about $4,000 travel expenses. In addition to her fee, about $4,000 travel expenses per gig. Almost all of these are in Canada. She lives in Ottawa. How much could she reasonably consume to go and speak in, let's say, Toronto, which is 200 and some miles away from Ottawa, even if she took a plane? Okay, maybe, I don't know, maybe $800 in airfare, couple of cabs, and let's add another $100 in there, a night in a hotel, let's call that $200, and some food. I have trouble getting past $1,000. Where does the $4,000 come from? Now, I suppose it would be possible to have a even more expensive hotel room, but she's not the Queen of England. Why would she need anything more than a comfortable accommodation? Don't know. She has to fly. Let's say she has to fly. Is it first class? We don't know. But why would the Prime Minister's mother have to fly for... But even if all of that was added in, I have trouble seeing how we get to 1,500. Now, it might be a little bit more if she had to fly from Ottawa to Vancouver or to Calgary and maybe spend two nights, comes in the day before, does her thing, stays overnight and goes back. I still see only maybe two nights in a hotel. How does this add up? Well, we're not told. Anyway, this is the Toronto Sun's Brian Lilly's take on the testimony of the Kielberger brothers on Tuesday before the House of Commons Finance Committee. The way Craig Kielberger tells it, he and his brother are doing the government a favor by taking on this program to give students money to volunteer. Forget the $43.5 million in administration fees his cash-strapped organization would get, which would just cover costs, some of $19 million of which was paid up front before the agreement with the government was even finally signed off on by the cabinet. It's grotesque. The co-founder of We Charity was doing his best to defend himself and the charity he and his brother started 25 years ago. Quote, We Charity agreed to implement the Canada Student Service Grant, not to be helped by government, but to help government and to help young people across Canada, Kielberger said. This is, of course, the... attack that's made on critics. You just don't want students to have a job. Well, actually, these aren't even really jobs. They're volunteer positions for which the students are given below the minimum wage recompense, which I think is utterly contradictory. Students need jobs, and this is a very difficult market right now with the widespread unemployment. The economy has been seriously wrecked by the the hysteria and the financial economic shutdown that's followed the COVID virus scandemic, much of which still remains in place. Anyway, back to the Brian Lilly column. He even went so far as to say that he wished he'd never answered the government's call for help, but sadly for him, he did, and now he has to deal with this controversy. At its heart, this is all about a conflict of interest. Did Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and the Liberals give a lucrative contract to a charity that they are close to? The obvious answer is yes, they did. Trudeau's brother, Alexandre has gotten over $30,000 for speeches at the at WE events. Margaret Trudeau, what with fees and expenses, has gotten over $500,000. All of this since Trudeau became prime minister. There's a lot of this just reeks of influence peddling. Did the government break the law? That isn't something the Kielbergers are going to answer on Tuesday, nor could they. That is on the government. That doesn't mean WE's hands are clean. The organization was actively lobbying the government for contracts despite not being registered to lobby. They have also plenty to answer for when it comes to hiring the Prime Minister's family to speak and appear at WE Day and other events only after Trudeau won the October 2015 election. How much was she paid? That's Margaret Trudeau for speaking before November the 2015. Conservative Member of Parliament Michael Barrett asked. We did not engage her before 2015. Mark Kielberger responded, "No, but she wasn't paid anything." That answer blew away any claim the Kielbergers made that she was hired because of her advocacy on mental health. That's the current party line. Margaret Trudeau's first book, where she opened up on the issue of mental health, basically her own, was published in October 2011. But they never hired her back then. And when one's to ask, what would be the overwhelming interest, again and again and again and again, to have this woman in her 60s, who's had a lot of mental health issues, talk to teenagers? Now, I'm not saying that speakers always have to be in the same age bracket, of course, to be relevant. I've never argued that. But you kind of wonder that on a strict... On its merit, what charm or even great relevance Margaret Trudeau brought to the WE events. I think she could have talked about the joys of knitting, because they weren't bringing her because the kids desperately, who are supposed to be motivated to act, to do charitable things, Margaret Trudeau's topic would not seem even to be particularly on topic. No, she could talk about the joys of macrame. Her purpose there was not whatever she might be saying to the impressionable young people, but her purpose was by being sweet to her, the Kielbergers were in a nice position to get government contracts, which magically, of course, came tumbling their way after Trudeau took power in 2015. Ryan Lilly continues. New Democrat MP Charlie Angus wasn't buying the claims. He said, "You're providing access to the Trudeau family. Don't you understand or realize that puts the Prime Minister into a serious conflict?" Angus asked the Kielbergers. Craig Kielberger responded by saying that Margaret Trudeau speaks at many charity events, and there's no way that just because people are speaking to the PM's mother, that government policy will change. "You're buying the name," Angus said. And that's true. I mean, Margaret Trudeau may indeed speak to many groups, but she spoke to we 28 times in several years and pocketed $500,000. Do you think that doesn't buy a little bit of goodwill with the Prime Minister, whose wife, of course, is also does podcasts for we and the so-called charity? And Trudeau himself, up until I think 2018, has spoken several times. They're connected. It's scratch my back, and I'll scratch yours. Quote, "Based on our understanding, it is a calculation based on time. Before April, we had minimal federal funding," Kielberger said. He's right, the lobbying rules do speak about the need to register based on time, spent soliciting the federal government. That is one of the equation. That said, We Charity has seen its funding go from $500,000 in the last few years of the Conservative Harper government to more than $5 million under the Trudeau Liberals over a several-year period. Craig and Mark Kielberger were actively pitching the government on multiple programs during the pandemic, something they laid out in detail during their testimony. Even if they didn't think they should have registered as lobbyists before, they certainly should have done so by April, when they were sending proposals to several cabinet ministers, taking meetings with them, and having calls from top civil servants. They didn't do that. That's the Kielbergers. What they did on Tuesday was to try and survive. They responded to questions, but I can't say they always answered them. Considering the incredible goodwill Canadians have granted we, plus the millions and millions of dollars in donations and government grants the Kielbergers owed Canadians, more than they offered on Tuesday. We denies hiring Maggie for her connections. That's Margaret Trudeau. The We Charity and its affiliated organizations paid out close to $500,000 just to have Margaret Trudeau speak on We Day and related events. All of it after her son Justin became Prime Minister. And that's what they do with the big boys. That was some of the news to come out of the House of Commons Finance Committee meeting yesterday. That's Tuesday. According to WE co-founder Mark Kielberger, Trudeau, the mother, was paid not only $312,000 in speaking fees, but $167,944 in travel and other costs. Quote, in the normal course of business, when somebody comes to WE Day, we also reimburse them for their direct cost, Mark Kielberger said. I have to ask, how is it possible to rack up over $4,000 per gig as reasonable costs? In addition to the $167,944 in expenses for Margaret Trudeau over 28 events, the organization paid $19,576 for Alexandra Trudeau, that's the Prime Minister's brother, for taking part in 8 events, and $25,326 for Sophie Trudeau, the Prime Minister's wife, for making 7 appearances. Although this is not, you know, infallible math, but she made 7 appearances, and she got $25,000 and change. So that's roughly $3,000 in expenses per event. Less per event than Margaret Trudeau got. But at $3,000, it too is mind-blowing. If these events are in Canada, it's hard to see how $3,000 per event would be, could be justified. The Kielberger said they hired Margaret Trudeau to speak at We Day events because her personal story, struggle and advocacy of issues on mental health. The mother of the current prime minister and ex-wife of former Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau first wrote extensively about mental health in her book, 2011 book called Changing My Mind. Yet the brothers admitted that they did not hire her until 5 years later in 2016, after Justin Trudeau had become prime minister. He also noted they hired Alexandre Trudeau, that's Trudeau's brother, to speak in 2017-2018 when Margaret was not available, calling him a well-known environmentalist and documentary filmmaker. So clearly some members on the committee thought that the whole Trudeau clan were hired because of the name. Very interesting. Other testimony, the former chairman of the board at We Charity says that she resigned after a heated call with Mark Kielberger and a demand from brother Craig. Michelle Douglas told the House of Commons Finance Committee Tuesday that in March 2020, that's this year, she was seized with the trouble we was facing due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Right? There were massive layoffs. The charity was seeing donations dry up, staff were being laid off at an alarming rate, and Douglas, along with other board members, were asking for data to help them understand why the layoffs were necessary and how the organization was faring. In other words, they weren't being given full financial disclosure. After the ad hoc committee Douglas had struck to deal with the financial crisis demanded to see data to back up the claims made by management, Douglas said she got a call from Craig. Quote, on March 25th, that's of this year, Craig Kielberger called me and asked me to resign as the chairman of the board of We Charity. Both Craig and Mark Kielberger tried to dismiss what Douglas told the committee as part of a planned replacement of the board. Douglas said there was nothing normal about her departure. On March 9th, I was asked to stay on for another year by the co-founder, Mark Kielberger, Douglas said. Yet just 2 weeks later, she was asked to leave. Douglas left the organization on March 27th, saying that there had obviously been a breakdown in trust between her and the founders. She also explained that despite neither of the Kielberger brothers being on the staff or the board of WE, the organization's structure gave them significant power. And that would be very interesting to explore further. The whole thing becomes increasingly a scandal. One more final thing about Margaret Trudeau. She explained that the reason her marriage to the father of her children, the former prime minister, Pierre Trudeau, broke down was that they were he had a Catholic understanding of marriage, which involves fidelity, one partner, marriage for life, etc. She found this traditional and old-fashioned. I think most people would say, Catholic or not, this is a pretty mainstream, and that was apparently the reason the marriage fell apart. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. I'm going to take my musical break right now, and why don't we hear a medley from Boxcar Willie. This is a medley of old Hank Williams songs, and Boxcar Willie, of course, is now passed on, but was in his time a great entertainer, of course, he's paying tribute to an equally great entertainer, the late Hank Williams. This is Boxcar Willie with a medley of Hank Williams songs, including...
I'm going to do you a little medley of a Hank Williams song. If you hear one you like, you tell me about it, okay? I tried so hard, my dear, to show that you're my every dream. If you're a pretty thing, I do is just some evil scheme. The more I learn to care for you, the more we drift apart. Why can't I free your dark old mind and melt your cold, cold heart? They spoke, but somebody didn't know this next song of Hank Williams. Here's the song that made his name famous all around our world. I got a feeling called the blues, oh Lord, since my baby said goodbye. Thought I don't know what I'll do. All I do is sit inside. Oh Lord, that last night beautiful dream. I hate to think it all over. I lost my heart, it seems. I've grown so used to you somehow. Well, we couldn't quit singing Hank Williams songs unless we did the first one that he ever put on record. Do y'all know what the first song he ever put out was? Goes like this. Came in last night at half past 10, that baby of mine, she wouldn't let me in, so moving on over.
That was Boxcar Willie, and really one of the greats. I'm going to play something here. I think you'll like, and this is Merle Haggard, and this is Merle Haggard with Gretchen Wilson. This is a great song. It's Gretchen Wilson's song, but with an assist from Merle Haggard. This is from about 10 years ago. Politically Uncorrect with Gretchen Wilson. Sometimes this would take a little bit of
must come down.
A trip to the grocery store or a tank of gas.
That's a family farm that's been in the family for over 100 years being sold.
They're concerned about the violence and the death.
Feels like I have, less money to spend.
Another deadly day in Iraq is 11 U.S. soldiers.
Sometimes there's just a little bit of a slowness here with the internet.
Hello, man on the totem pole, and I'm for the underdog. God bless his soul, and I'm for the guys still
Again, this I have to apologize for the slowness of the recording here. We do have our problems, don't we? Gretchen Wilson here.
And I'm for
nothing wrong with the flag.
Nothing wrong with the working man. Me and the
Gretchen Wilson, and this is Paul Fromm, and I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever, and I'll be back with you again tomorrow, and this is the anthem of the real Canada. I always love the lyrics and the tune, the Maple Leaf Forever, and back with you again tomorrow. This is the thank you.